From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1996 in Nashville, Tennessee. A woman named Kay Loki got her first job in law enforcement. She was hired as a Nashville patrol officer. The next 25 years would take her to many different parts of policing. She became a school resource officer. She was promoted to sergeant in 2004 in the Nashville department. After several more promotions, Kay Loki was elevated to deputy chief of Nashville Police last year. Her story remains rather unusual. The latest data indicates that only about 12% of American police officers are women. Fewer still, about 3%, are chiefs or deputy chiefs. Now, there's no obvious answer to the question, what would happen if policing had a balance in gender? But for decades, there's been speculation about the possible impacts of bringing a lot more women into law enforcement. That was the focus of a recent event organized in Rochester, but featuring participants from Nashville, yes, Memphis, Northampton, Houston, and more. Here's how organizers posed their interest. Quote, "Unfortunately, we have seen too many horrible interactions between police officers and civilians throughout our history. Many of those instances have involved male police officers who are a part of police departments that are likely led by men. What would happen if we focused on shifting that dynamic and ensuring that more women are at the policymaking tables for our police units?" End quote. And there is data backing up some of the speculation. CNN has collected some data. We'll share more of it coming up, but essentially, some of that data indicates that women in policing are less likely to use violence or force compared to men in policing. They're less likely to use deadly force. So we'll talk about that and a lot more. And one of the people who organized this event was Virgil Parker, an HBCU graduate and a community advocate here in Rochester. Welcome. Thanks for being with us in studio. Also with us on the phone is Kim Craven, Executive Director of the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives and the Director of the Public Safety Strategies Group. Kim, thanks for making time for the program.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for putting a focus on this really important issue.
Absolutely. And Deputy Chief Natalie K. Loki is with us from the Nashville Police Department. Deputy Chief Loki, thank you for making time for us.
Well, thank you for allowing us to be part of this very important conversation.
Let me just start on how this came together. It was a few weeks ago in Rochester, and there were chiefs. Obviously, Rochester currently has a woman who is the police chief here. There were participants from a number of the cities that I mentioned. Virgil, tell us about how some of this came together.
Absolutely. So a few weeks ago before this event, I had a conversation with Mayor Warren and our deputy chief. It was a public conversation about improving police community relations. And after that conversation, our chief here acknowledged the now chief of Memphis, Chief C.J. Davis, who was now the first African-American woman to lead that department. And that got me thinking about how often do we have a conversation about the inequities that are facing women in policing. So I reached out to NALI at Kim Craven, the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives, and said, can we have a conversation about this, about investing more in women in this space and what the benefit of that would be? And they absolutely loved it. So she reached out to her partners. The Rochester Police Chief reached out to CJ Davis and Vera Bumpers out of Houston, and we came together to have this very important dialogue.
How do you feel like this community could be impacted by a change? You're not in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. You're a community advocate. You're mm-hmm. working towards equity across a range of spectrums. Mm-hmm. How do you think this community would impact it if we saw more of a balance from what you're learning?
Absolutely. It would be impacted so much in a positive way. I cannot tell you how many times I've heard, just for example, with the Daniel Prude situation here at Rochester, that if more women or women in general were interacting with Daniel Prude, he could possibly still be alive today. You know, we have women who lead differently. They lead uniquely. They have very valuable perspectives and intellect, and they also lead statistically with more compassion. So I think it'd be valuable to have their input, and just because it's the proper thing to do to make sure that women are a part of this space, the community will certainly benefit.
I want to read a little bit of how CNN has analyzed this and some of the data collected, and then we'll talk to our guests on the phone about maybe how they see possible benefits to bringing more women into law enforcement. First of all, in a piece for CNN by Ashley Fance and Casey Tolan called "Want to Reform the Police? Hire More Women," they write, quote, "It was a moment that captured national attention and revealed an important lesson about police reform. A Fort Lauderdale, Florida policeman, facing off against a line of yelling demonstrators, sticks his finger in the face of a protester. He then turns toward a kneeling woman, her hands raised in protest. The officer suddenly lunges and shoves her. Then a female officer appears. She swats her male colleague back toward a line of patrol cars, waving her arm and appearing to upbraid him for what he has just done, end quote. In their piece, they take a look at the data. Let me quote from that now. Quote, CNN's analysis of data from four cities supports the idea that women officers use less force. Women officers in Orlando carried out 8% of the uses of force between 2009 and 2019. They make up 17% of that department. In Cincinnati, women officers carried out 13% of episodes of use of force from 2000 through 2018, 13%, but they currently comprise 23% of that force. In Indianapolis, women officers carried out 9% of uses of force. They make up 13% of those officers. And in New Orleans, women officers carried out 10% of the uses of force, but they make up nearly 23% of that department for the years in which federal data is available, end quote. Now, use of force is just one part of this. It's what Virgil brought up first. It's not everything, but it's a big part of it. It's what CNN largely focused on. Let me ask our guests, and I'm gonna start with Kim Craven, who's the executive director of this organization that is seeking to do such work to take the numbers up to at least 30% or more. We'll talk about that. How much of this is about use of force and interactions with the public, Kim?
It's a piece of it for sure. But the fact that women are so underrepresented in the policing profession is our overall topic. The decrease in use of force is something that we highlight because it does make a difference. The numbers that you stated, you know, there's a statistical difference between the ratio of women and the use of force. So that's an important part of the conversation. But just like in big business, policing will benefit drastically from having more diversity, women and communities of color involved in decision making, involved in how the community is policed. Big business has shown that diversity of thought helps the bottom line. It would help policing. It would help our communities as well. So again, the use of force is one piece of it, but the collaborative nature of women, the comfort level that many victims feel when there is a woman there to interact with them after an incident, you know, that's been proven valuable to communities. The problem-solving capabilities of women and just the different angle that they look at how to interact with people would benefit. So, you know, not every person in the community is committing crime, and the police department serves many people in the community. So those other skills, and you know, people refer to them as soft skills. I just refer to them as good skills. You know, relationship development, that's important. And I do believe that the more women we can get into the policing profession, we will see less use of force, but we're just going to see better relationships in general.
Kim, when I think about the numbers that CNN reported, that do appear to me to be not sort of just a fluke or kind of an outlier. It does appear that the more cities you look at it, it's pretty uniform that in general, women who are officers use force less. I remember many reactions from listeners on this program over the years when we talk about police reform. The pushback usually sounds something like this. If we make police scared to use force, even when they think they should, their lives will be endangered. That's some of the pushback in general, in an effort to get especially American police and law enforcement to use force less. And so I can imagine some listeners saying, if women are less likely to be willing to use force, then that could be dangerous, that they need to be able to use force just as much as anybody because their lives may be in danger. What would you say to criticism that sounds roughly like that, Kim?
Certainly I can understand people worrying about safety of officers if the climate is such that officers are being injured. Now, we do have incidents that are happening all across the country where officers, men and women, are being killed by community members during traffic stops, domestic violence incidences. And sadly, you know, we will try to continue to change that trend, but that is an outcome of our profession. So in general terms, however, I have not seen any studies that show that women have a propensity to be injured more often on duty because they're not using force. That's not to say there's some research out there. I don't know every document that exists, but we're not seeing an uptick of women being injured because they're using different strategies. And a lot of it, I think, comes down to the training, right? So we want to make sure that all officers, male and female, are trained to the highest degree possible to read situations, to de-escalate, to work with community members, to get them to not use violence against them or any other members of the community. So it's not something that I'm seeing as an occurrence, as you know, a female in the profession, Chief Loke, could talk about it a bit more, but I don't think that that is a factor in bringing more women into the profession or using less force. You know, I don't think that the argument would be valid that if we use less force, we're going to be harmed more. If we can de-escalate situations and build those relationships, I think everyone will be safer.
Deputy Chief Kay Loke from Nashville is on the line with us. And Deputy Chief Loke, let's just start on that particular subject before we get into how we recruit, how departments recruit, what they focus on, what the standards are, and what might change all of this. When we look at use of force, does it surprise you at all to see the disparity between men and women who are officers? Does that reflect what you experience?
Oh, it absolutely does. As a female officer answering calls for service, my goal was always to have the individual handcuffed and placed in the back of my car and us having a nice discussion on the way to booking. When I could not achieve that, that's when I felt that I failed. When I had to use force, go hands-on, to me, that was not good policing tactics. So I think it's the mindset that women bring to this profession. We're not saying that there will be circumstances that someone may have to go to their duty belt to use a pepper spray or a taser. What we're saying is that you establish a relationship with the person you're dealing with, and you create a time and distance. This is a big part of de-escalation. You try that first, and then it's up to the subject how they want to interact with you, because you're giving them the benefit that I'm here, I'm going to treat you with dignity, let's resolve this in the most you know, safest manner, because we both want to go home at the end of the day. So I think women have just a different approach to policing. They want to talk, they want to communicate, but we're not saying that you stick to that. If it's not working, then through the training academy, through our in-service training, we're taught to deal with those type of situations. And we always want to leave the individual better than we found them.
Why do you think men who are officers are more quick to just go to force and not use some of the approach that you just described that women are more likely to use? Is it simply just a biological difference that's sort of hardwired into our nature?
You know, I have to be careful when I talk about this because I never want to discredit the men that came before me. They built a very honorable profession. But society has said in the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, police, we're not sure we're really comfortable with how we're being policed, and we need you to rethink this, reconsider it. And what we've come up with, it just seems that women seem to have the skill set that comes with that. Part of our recruitment effort is, if you have character, if you have empathy, problem-solving skills, a critical thinker, you have dignity, come work for the Metro Nashville Police Department. We'll train you to do the rest. I can't always give you empathy. I can't always give you problem-solving skills, but I can teach you to do everything else. And it's just rethinking what we want from our police.
Mm-hmm. Virgil, you mentioned Daniel Prudes. Let me just ask you briefly again. No one is able to sit here today and prove that things would have been totally different, somewhat different, that Daniel Prudes would still be alive in different circumstances. You believe it's possible that if women officers were primarily the ones who responded to that call on March 23rd, 2020, it's possible he'd still be alive.
I absolutely do. And let me just say how much I appreciate as a civilian listening to these two leaders, these two ladies on this call, talking about how they would take a rational approach to interacting with civilians, persons of interest, and how they encourage women to do that generally in officers in general. Because I do believe if women were interacting with Daniel Prudes, George Floyd, and other individuals, that we could have a different outcome and they could be living today. We want to make it a cultural norm that you don't just immediately jump to deadly force when wanting to engage these types of individuals. And it's unfortunate the condition that, you know, we have, the people like Daniel Prude and George Floyd are in today. And I'm hoping that inclusion of more women officers and more women leaders can shape the policies and the outcomes and the behavior around police officers. Absolutely.
So the question of how we get to a situation where only 12% of police officers are women across the country, only 3% are chiefs and executives in law enforcement. Part of it comes to recruiting and retention. And this is something that a number of journalists have been writing about. And so let me quote a little bit more from what journalist Ashley Fance writes about this. Quote, police departments face two problems in increasing the number of women with a badge, recruiting them and keeping them on the force. That starts, expert said, with the way some departments advertise for new recruits, with commercials that predominantly feature men and deliver a more diehard than officer-friendly image of policing, guns blazing, men rappelling down buildings, high-octane car chases. Ads that highlight big guns and militaristic standoffs have been used to recruit new police officers in cities from Alexandria, Louisiana, to Brunswick, Georgia, to Melbourne, Florida, even places like Palo Alto, California, a wealthy Silicon Valley suburb that had 90 incidents of violent crime in 2017, the year their ad with militaristic features was released. End quote. Kim Craven, executive director of the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives, is that part of it? Is the way we advertise these jobs part of why there is a big, big disparity in gender and policing?
It's really so many different things, Evan, that come into this. But the advertisement, the way, just as you said, the militaristic features that police departments put on their webpage, into their brochures and videos, it doesn't show oftentimes a place for women. That's why we're really excited at the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives to be one of the founding partners of the 30 by 30 initiative, which is to advance women in policing to obtain 30% representation by the year 2030. Deputy Chief Loke actually sits on that steering committee as well. And we're partnered with the Policing Project of NY School of Law, leading researchers and policing experts from around the country who we're all donating our time essentially to this cause. We do at NOLI have some funding from the Office of Community Policing Services, but the COPS office has limited funding to provide us. But that's some seed money, and we've received a little bit of funding. But essentially, it's people coming together to see that this needs to change. So we have experts that have analyzed recruitment videos and messaging to women. We're part of a research project looking at what women are attracted to in policing and how we can promote that, what policies need to change, you know, how can the culture of policing change and be more welcoming to women. So it is what you say about that forward-facing image of the military side of policing, which that is such a small percentage of what police officers do every day. And the side that is attractive to women, the engagement, the collaboration, the really working with the community members, the outreach and problem solving, is not reflected as much, and we're finding that makes a difference. The other thing.
Please go ahead, Kim. I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's say that the other thing that is really important is getting young people to the table, and that's why we're so excited when Mr. Parker came forward and said that he was interested in this topic. It's not all on the burden of those of us that have been in the career for 25, 30 years. It's that new enthusiasm for diversity in law enforcement that's really going to make a difference for our agencies and our communities.
And let me ask Deputy Chief Loke from Nashville if you think that there is, and maybe this is generally speaking, because I don't know how your department has attempted to recruit new officers, but has there been sort of this guns blazing car chase focus too often in law enforcement when recruiting for new officers?
Yeah, I believe so. 98% of our job is talking with people, having calm, collective conversations. And, you know, we often joke that, you know, maybe once a week we might have to chase somebody. It's more about building relationships. It's more about getting to the root cause and trying to understand why this individual called me as a police officer to their home. I think we need to change the narrative, and we need to redefine what we want in a police officer. And I think there's still advertisement out there that shows all the excitement and repelling and the SWAT. And those are very vital aspects of a police department, but they're not the voice of a department. They're not the foundation.
Yeah, and let me just sort of take this one step further and ask Virgil for your thoughts on this, because I'll tell you what comes to mind for me. If there are ads that depict sort of the guns blazing, the dangerous moments, the car chases, the rappelling, et cetera, whatever. When you talk to police officers, mm-hmm. as we talk on this program with some frequency, mm-hmm. they'll tell you that they don't want to use force. They mm-hmm. don't want to be in a situation where someone could die. They are in this job and they're ready to do that if necessary, but that is not something that they want to do unless they absolutely must. Mm-hmm. So my question would be, Virgil, why do the ads that these departments create offer those very moments that could lead to death as something sexy or desirable? Why do you want to bring in people who would see that and think, that sounds cool, I want that, as opposed to thinking, I hope I never end up in a chase. I hope I never have to pull a weapon or use force. I will be trained to do it if I must, but that's not the sexy, cool thing that I want to do. That's kind of because an ad is supposed to appeal to what lights you up. I don't mm-hmm. want people lit up by that stuff.
Right.
That's kind of what comes to mind for me. I wonder what you think.
No, that's a great point. I come to think of this about the same thing as a civilian. Why are we, advertising these things? I've heard some things I've heard from as complaints from police officers is that, well, people in the community may not respect them because of fear. Well, look at what you're mainstreaming through the media. Look at what we are consuming as individuals about how the daily role of a police officer looks like. And to your point, into what Deputy Chief Lokey and Ms. Kim are saying, that is not very accurate, right? I don't know people who want to wake up in the morning and say, well, my destination, my objective today is to kill somebody, even though I'm a police officer. That shouldn't be the outcome, right? And it does a lot of mental damaging and trauma, I can sort of imagine. So absolutely, I don't understand why that is advertised that way in the media. And I think that it should definitely change to a more, proper depiction.
And then the next step beyond that, as journalist Casey Tolan writes about, is not just the advertising and recruiting, but then the kind of testing that departments are doing before someone is brought onto a force. And let me read a little bit about fitness tests, which no one is saying officers shouldn't be fit. I mean, of course they should. But when you hear Deputy Chief Lokey say, 90% of interactions are talking to people and problem solving, you wonder why such an emphasis is not only on physical fitness, but according to some in the legal profession, discriminatory. So let me read from what Casey Tolan has written about this. Quote, in Colorado Springs, a federal judge ruled in 2017 that the local police department's fitness test discriminated against women, leading the department to stop using the test and awarding the 12 plaintiffs more than $2.4 million in settlement. Half of female recruits failed that test, while only 6% of male recruits failed the test, according to the judge's ruling. But experts say most police work is based more on interpersonal skills than upper body strength, and that those tests can arbitrarily make it more difficult for women to get hired. Some departments have already started to reform fitness testing. In Texas, the State Department of Public Safety released a model policy that replaces tests involving push-ups, running, or pull-ups with a single rowing test that has differing requirements based on age, gender, and weight. Several cities like Austin have already adopted it, end quote. Deputy Chief Lokey, what do you make of that? Fitness tests and how much emphasis departments ought to be giving them?
There's more to being physically fit to perform certain duties of your job. Often, if you're physically fit, you're mentally fit. It goes hand in hand. We sit in our patrol cars most of our day, so it's important for us to be physically fit. And there may be times where we may need to climb over our chain link fence. There may be times that we, might need to hop over something. So I think departments should challenge themselves to look at how they do their physical agility test, and is it job specific? We recently, like a year ago, stopped incorporating push-ups in our physical agility test because I can't remember the last time I answered a call and I had to do push-ups. So We need to think about being job specific when we test individuals. We need to think about getting them prepared at a certain level when they graduate that they can go out and perform certain tasks that they might come across. So, yeah, I applaud Austin. I applaud Texas for taking a hard look at how they're doing their tests. And I think it's a work in progress. I think more departments are starting to look at this. If we're saying we value character over your ability, your physical fitness, then we've got to show that from day one.
Yeah, I wonder, Kim, how you feel about that, too.
It's such an important topic, and one of our leading experts on that, Yvonne Roman, has done much research and education for departments around making the standards fit the job. It's vitally important. The other part of that is that the fitness standards that are in place should not be a secret. For a mentoring process to happen pre-academy, for both men and women to really understand what the fitness requirements are, is so important for them to prepare. If they're just finding out about that when they're doing their testing, it's going to leave folks behind. And so having clarity of purpose with the fitness standards, make sure that they are actually, based on the job function, as Chief Loki says, there's not a call I've ever heard of where someone had to do push-ups. So, some of those things can be nonsensical, and we can test that fitness in a different way, a way that is actually job-related and does not have discriminatory factors in it for women. For the study that Yvonne did in New Jersey, the numbers were really staggering for the amount of women that were doing fine academically, had the emotional intelligence to do the job, but the fitness standards were just not in keeping with the job needs. So changing that and making folks aware of how they can have requirements in place, but make it so that it is one that women and men can pass and one that serves the community as well.
Virgil, you want to add to that?
Absolutely. I've heard conversations about how, and this is one thing we didn't address during the event, I wish we did, the two stigmas about women being too emotional for this job and physically unfit. And that's just not true. I've never seen data to support that women cannot do this job because they don't have the physical means, or that they're too emotional. They may get tearful. They may get anything.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing at that.
It's
the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I am so tired. Women in politics. Bill O'Reilly used to say that about women, that women would be too emotional to be executive leaders in Washington. If anything, we've seen that men do not have the emotional capacity. I'm glad you bring that up.
There's something I wanted to address.
I'm not saying men don't, by the way. I'm just saying it's a ridiculous idea to say that women are uniquely emotionally unsuited for police or politics.
I don't see that. And one thing I'd say to change this issue, and like what Texas did by leadership, one stat we hadn't shared yet, and I thank Nolly for this, they found from a survey in 2013 that only about 169 women were leading the nation's 1,500 plus law enforcement agencies, police units, whatsoever. If we get more women involved, we can change that top-down policy so that this police structure that we have in America is more inclusive for women. But no, absolutely.
All right. So after we take our only break of the hour, we're going to talk a little bit about what convinced Kay Loki to get into policing. I just want to know a little bit more about her decision to not only take up this career, but stay in a profession in which a lot of women who get into it leave. And now she's in a leadership position. We'll talk about that. We're going to talk about the 30-30 goals and this initiative that says 12% of police in America being women, not enough. 3% of chiefs and executives being women, not enough. 30% is a baseline. How do you get there? What can change that? I've got some of your emails. Listeners have sent emails to connections at WXXI.org. We'll read some of that. And I'm wondering what police chiefs who are largely men have said about some of these initiatives, and I'm sure Kim especially has probably got had a lot of interactions over the years with men in leadership about some of their efforts. So we'll take our only break, and we'll come right back. I just talked to Virgil Parker, who is an HBCU graduate and a community advocate who helped put together this forum last month, focusing on the impact of bringing more women into law enforcement. Deputy Chief Natalie K. Loki from Nashville is with us, and Kim Craven, the Executive Director of the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives, also the director of the Public Safety Strategies Group, is with us as well. And we're right back here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Dr. Lucy McBride joins us from Washington, D.C. She's the author of a popular COVID newsletter, and she wrote a recent piece, A COVID Serenity Prayer, in which she talks about accepting what we cannot change and working toward mitigating COVID while still living our lives and understanding risk. We'll talk about that with her next hour.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to get right to an email from Charles, who writes to say, Evan, we should try to attract qualified candidates of both genders because we should, of course, base everything in life on qualification and not demographics. You're interpreting the data wrong on fitness. If 50% of women fail the fitness test, that means 50% pass, and therefore it's possible for women to pass. Don't you think the standard for officers should be raised rather than lowered? That is from Charles. Let me start with Kim Craven, Executive Director of the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives. What would you say to Charles, Kim?
Joe, I like it when people are optimistic. However, I think it's really important that we have standards that are meaningful. Yes, if some are passing, that's great. But can we have standards that really typify what needs to happen during a call for service, during a time when you have to help a community member? Maybe they've been in a car crash, or someone has gotten hurt, or there's something that you have to move. What are those skills like? How do you test for that type of proficiency? And that's what we're after here, is to make these standards fit the job and not just be arbitrary, exercises, if you will. The running, stamina is important, but is there a different way to test stamina? Being able to move things is important, but is the weightlifting test the way to do it? Upper body strength is not something that is typically needed in policing, and so the push-ups, is that meaningful? Is it more job-oriented, skills-based testing that actually would depict what happens in a typical call for service? We believe that would be more meaningful and let people that are suited for the job emotionally be able to pass these standards and enter the profession.
Deputy Chief Loki, what would you say to the email?
It kind of is why we're having this discussion. We're redefining what police work is. And we're not saying people don't need to be physically fit. There's no one saying that. We're just saying, what are the dynamics that we measure this physical fitness? And is it accurate to the job? I think that most of these physical fitness tests that I have been reviewing lately that other departments are performing are just as vigorous and just as taxing as maybe running that mile and a half in 15 minutes and something seconds. So think about what the job is, think what it takes to do the job, and then test for that.
Thank you, Charles, for the email, and I'll get back to feedback in just a second. But Deputy Chief Loki, your first job in Nashville was 25 years ago. What attracted you to this line of work to begin with?
I have a very unusual story. I was about 29 years old. I was going to night school, trying to finish a degree. I was working at UPS, and I was tired and burned out. So my older sister calls and says, you need to go down to the police training academy and fill out an application. And I laughed at her. I said, there is no way that they would want me. And she said, I've got a feeling about this. Just fill out the application. What do you got to lose? And 6 months later, I'm standing in formation at the police training academy, and I was hired under the COPS grant in 1996. And as I went through the training academy, every day I questioned, what am I doing? What am I thinking? But as I got into the training and the profession, I soon realized I'm a people person. I want to help. I want to contribute. And there were, you know, community policing was a buzzword back then, and we were still learning to try to define that. And as I grew into this, I found the opportunities, the things that would fit me, you know, being able to build relationships, getting to the root cause of people's situations, making them better than I found them. That was my calling. And so it was a fluke that I ended up. I often tell people I shouldn't be a deputy chief, but I was steered the correct way in 1996, and I'm very thankful for that.
Did you experience any sexism in your career?
I think you would experience in any male-dominated field. So, you know, that's just part of one thing that we have to do as women are hired on as police officers, as they rise through the rank. We have to acknowledge it. We have to deal with it. And that's why we need more women in policing, so we can have those conversations.
How many women were on the force when you started?
That's a really good question. I would have to guess probably about 80.
80 out of how many?
At the time, it was 1,200, I believe.
Wow. Okay. And do you know roughly what that number is now?
We're about almost 12%. And so that's been part of our goal for the last year and a half. You know, I've got a chief, John Drake, who completely supports women. So as I oversee the recruitment division and the training academy division, and as we put things forward, he's fully behind it. And it's that kind of messaging. It's got to come directly from the top and work its way down. He understands and recognizes the value that women bring. So, you know, when I bring him ideas and I think, oh, he's not going to go for this, you know, he's very open to it. And that's what we need more of.
And so I want to talk to Kim Craven about what a realistic and appropriate goal here is for numbers. And let me just say a few things as I kick it over to Kim about this, because over the years on this program, we've had some really interesting and sometimes tough conversations about gender differences and career interest. If you remember James Damore and the Google memo about women in tech, that sparked a national conversation. Where there were questions about, you know, is your goal equal opportunity or just equal outcome? And what's the difference? And can we acknowledge that there are maybe natural gender differences in interest in careers, and that if all things were equal, would more men end up in construction and more women end up, you know, wherever? And so one of the things I've really come to think is that there probably are some differences. I mean, I'm sure careers have some differences among the genders in terms of who would want to be where, but the disparity 88-12 is huge, huge. And to me, that's doesn't just say that, well, you know, naturally women don't want to be police. We've created this idea that we've been talking about this hour, that policing is some sort of, you know, it's advertised as this violent, sexy, you know, sort of video game look to it that does look a little bit more stereotypically male and testosterone driven, as opposed to what it usually actually is, which is just interacting with the public and trying to solve problems and trying to avoid violence. And so I think, you know, I don't know what the actual number would shake out to be in terms of, you know, a balanced force. I don't know that it's 50-50. I don't know that it's 60-40. I don't know that it's 40-60. But I am curious to know what Kim Craven thinks is appropriate, what the current goals are, what 30-30 means. So, Kim, there's a lot there. Why don't you take us through, you know, maybe how you see those goals and how you're working toward them?
So, sure. You just put a lot on the table there, Evan. So first and foremost, we don't want just diversity. We want inclusion. So it's not just about changing the numbers. It's about changing the numbers in a meaningful way. So at NOLI, we do a couple things. I've mentioned the COPS office, the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services. They provided a grant to NOLI so that we could look at gender differences in the workplace. And we really talk about this in the same way that we talk about generations in the workplace. There's certain tendencies. It doesn't mean that everybody's the same. We don't want to be stereotypical. But if we really look at how people interact, how people make decisions, and the value that both men and women bring to the table, that's first and foremost. It's not us against them. It's how do we get them to support us? And Deputy Chief Loki mentioned something really important, is that leadership at the top. And so we've found in our quest for getting folks to sign the pledge, naturally, we are going to be talking with more male police leaders than we are female, because there's more of them. And so if you look at our numbers, we started on March 25th, and 30 by 30 now has well over 100 agencies that have signed the pledge. We are asking them to intentionally look at their hiring practices. Where do women fall out of the process? Where do they succeed? What are the policies and practices in place within the organization? What is the path towards promotion? You know, we've been providing through the work of Moma Goff, who is the founding, sort of the brain trust behind 30 by 30. She's been helping to organize all of us and all of the talent on the steering committee to pull that information from the leading researchers about what are the best policies and practices, so what are the best fitness standards, what are the practices around women that are raising children and having children, how to make sure that they are included in the workforce, how do we include the right hiring practices around emotional intelligence. So all of those pieces are being put into workshops that are held monthly for agencies that sign on. And I should note that becoming a member of 30 by 30 doesn't cost the agency any money. We're actively providing these services free of charge so that agencies can learn from the steering committee members, learn from other practitioners in the field, learn from international communities about how they have increased the number of women in the in profession. So if we look at other countries that are well over the 30% mark, how did they do that? So we're bringing them to the table to talk to us. The other part of the recruitment piece and getting women in is the mentoring program. We truly believe that mentoring helps women in policing just as it does people in the business field, right? The more that you can mentor someone and show them the path forward in their career, whether it's a specialized position or if they want to stay in patrol, how they can be the very best, how the agency can support them, and how they can be an active follower within the organization. So that's part of it. Providing that framework for agencies is just really important. We do believe that that 30% will allow enough culture change within the organization and enough numbers. You know, like you've looked at numbers, you were asking about what Metro Nashville is at right now. They're doing about average. We have some like Madison, Wisconsin, that are very high. And then we have some like the Arizona Department of Public Safety that just has 41 out of over 1,000 members that are women. So we look at each organization, where they're at, how they can do better. And it's that collective resolve, Evan, that's going to get us there. All of these police leaders are coming together with the cause of diversity and inclusion. So with that many folks signing on, I think we'll make a difference. Obviously, it takes time to get there.
Yeah, and Kim, do you have some police chiefs who say, not interested, this is ridiculous?
We have had some police chiefs, both men and women, say that, you know, they're too busy or it's not a priority. We'll keep working on them. We're not going to, stop until the mission is complete. And we can understand that when you look at the 30 by 30 website, there's a lot of information on there. There's a lot of steps. But everybody is there to support agencies through this process. And we try to reassure everyone that, you know, we want you to sign the pledge. We want you to be involved. We need you to do a little bit of research. We need you to be active participants. But if somebody doesn't make it, it's not punitive. We want to support folks that are struggling. And, you know, do they need more help from some of our researchers with the information on their recruitment video? Do they need help from someone like Yvonne Roman with their fitness standards? Do they need help with changing how they hire from absolute preference of military veterans, which, you know, is mostly men, to doing more of emotional intelligence-based testing requirements that don't give absolute preference for military, which I know, that people have very strong feelings about being inclusive of military, but I feel like right now everything is on the table. Sometimes people will say, well, it's the hours. Well, we know that's not 100% accurate because nursing is a profession that is, very inclusive of women, dominated by women, and their hours are long mm-hmm. and their weekend hours. So it's really finding out what makes the agencies work that do work and highlighting and finding those male leaders. Right now, our incoming president of IACP, Dwight Henninger from Vail, Colorado, he's been a longtime member of NAWLI. Chief Jimmy Perdue from North Richland Hills has been intentionally investing in women in his organization, and now he has them, as part of his command staff. Fifth Vice President Doug Shoemaker from Grand Junction, Colorado, put out a video focusing just on women. So it's getting the male leaders that are there behind this cause, convincing enough to join the pledge and do the work that's necessary. While we say we'd like to be the last generation of firsts, we do know that there's some obstacles that we still have to climb. I have about 10 years more in the profession than Kay does. So, we're really pushing really hard to make sure that we can make this change for our agencies and most importantly for our communities. We want to create safe spaces, and we know that increasing the amount of women will do that.
All right. Before we wrap the hour, I would love all three of our guests to respond to an email from a listener who asked to remain anonymous, who says, I'm listening to you talk about women's ability to approach situations with more empathy, understanding, etc., where your show is saying they are better at de-escalating tense situations generally. I wish we could take the women adjective out of this conversation and talk about people who are empathetic and skilled at de-escalating situations instead. Maybe we should think about how we raise empathetic people. Males and females. Maybe if boys were allowed to play with dolls or play house, they may have a chance to develop those empathetic, nurturing, caring skills. Maybe I'm a dreamer, hoping for a more peaceful world for our sons, who are bombarded with masculine stereotypes and surrounded by an overwhelming boy culture, forcing them to act and react in certain outdated ways. Person asked to remain anonymous. Deputy Chief Loki, what would you say to that?
Well, I think that's spot on. Everybody has something to contribute to a profession, whether you're male or female. Policing has just really been beaten up lately, and as we examine how we handle ourselves and how we go forward and doing our business, we've also determined that, you know what, there's a huge empathetic element here that maybe has been missing. And at right now, I have a lot of hope for the younger generation. They do seem to be more empathetic. They do seem to care more about social issues. So my hope is that this dialogue we're having today could morph into, hey, how about everybody that's interested in police work think and believe and come with these capabilities? So I do. I have a lot of hope for the next generation that replaces me.
Kim, about 30 seconds. What do you think?
So I couldn't agree more, and I smiled as you were reading that. I have a nephew. He's very successful in life and in his relationships, and he grew up walking around with a doll in one hand and a briefcase in the other. So I think, more peaceful communities is something that we would all welcome, and I don't disagree. I know that for right now, we have a window of opportunity to recruit more women. That's something that I can contribute to, but whomever that anonymous person is, I'd love to have them, step forward and really help build peaceful communities. And Mr. Parker is someone that person could get connected to, because I think that's in his heart as well. and so yes, that is the big picture, and what we're dealing with right now with the focus on women is just a symptom of where we've been in our profession, and we're trying to give it our all to change that and help contribute to communities that are livable for everyone.
All right, 30 seconds, Mr. Parker.
Absolutely. I have to agree with the email. I really wish that we can get to a sense of uniformity when raising more empathetic leaders within the police force, regardless of gender. But I understand that we also can't get to uniformity until we have a balance of representation amongst the different genders within the police unit. So we can do both, but I definitely agree with the person who wrote the email, and I thank them for that.
Where do people find you on social media, Virgil?
Absolutely. You can find me on social media on Twitter. I'm at Virgil_Parker. That's VIRGIL_Parker. And on Instagram at Virgil_.P for more content on this issue and others. I want to thank Nolly, and I also want to thank First Genesis Baptist Church here of Rochester, New York, for helping to organize this. This is a really important dialogue.
It's an important event, and I know you and I will talk again soon about this and many other issues.
Yes.
Thank you for being here. And I want to thank our guests on the line, Kim Craven, the Executive Director of the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives. Where can people learn more about your organization, Kim?
So please follow us on Twitter at Nolly, and you can go to our webpage, which is nolly.org. And we're on LinkedIn as well. National Association of Women Law Enforcement has a page in the group, and we'd love to talk to anyone. And email at info@nawlee.org.
And Nawlee is N-A-W-L-E-E. Thank you, Kim, and thank you to Deputy Chief Natalie K. Loki from the Nashville Police Department. Deputy Chief Loki, thanks for your time this hour.
Thank you.
And I just want to say to listeners, you may be wondering, you say, hey, Rochester has a woman police chief who is stepping down. We did invite, and always will, Rochester Police under Mayor Lovely Warren for the last 4 years. No one from the city, no one from police has been given the green light to come on this program. That could perhaps change with the new mayor coming in, and we certainly hope so. Our thanks to all of our guests, and we've got much more connections coming up in a moment.